This podcast is brought to you by the patrons at patreon.com. To support this show, please visit patreon.com/Keith Burgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today, I wanted to talk about something which we've alluded to a little bit in the past few episodes, which is this idea of the relationship between board games and video games, and how I think game designers should look at those two media. Because I think there's a few ideas that kind of float around about board games and board game design that are pretty reasonable mistakes to make, but I think they're still mistakes, and I'd like to bring them up. I'm also going to talk a little bit about this idea of abstract. I got some comments recently about abstract games and how my podcast is for abstract game design and things like that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that as well. The first thing that we think about with game design when we're getting into it, and especially if we're starting out with video game design, which many of us are, we kind of have this feeling of you can do anything. You know, you can There's kind of like no limitations. A computer will allow you to do just about anything that you can imagine in terms of complexity and in terms of, you know, if you want to do a Go board that's 1,000 by 1,000 or even larger, 10 times as big as that, you know, there's no limits in those, in that kind of a regard. If you wanted to make a game that has a billion cards, you can just have it sort of generate them, types of cards. You can have, you know, procedural generation. As we talked about in the last episode, you can have really deep AI. You can have countless things that obviously you can't do with cards and paper. So that's really exciting, I think, for a lot of new designers. They are very excited by that. And, you know, we have some games that kind of really embrace that. Probably the one that comes to mind first for me would be NetHack, which is known as, you know, it's one of the most popular roguelike games. And it sort of has this, it actually has an item in the game, just to kind of explain. This is probably the best way to explain how much stuff is in NetHack. A lot of people don't know this, but it has so much stuff in it. They actually have a kitchen sink in the game. And that's a reference to, like, you know, everything but the kitchen sink. They even have a kitchen sink. Like, there's so many items. There's just so much complexity in that game in terms of the number of items, number of monsters, the number of unique, weird things that can happen and interactions. It's extremely, extremely, extremely complex. And so that's something that computers can do. And I think that a lot of people find that really exciting. And I will definitely grant that there is, an excitement to knowing that, wow, this thing has so many layers that I can just like discover. It's kind of like sifting through this massive old encyclopedia and just finding all the weird stuff that's in there. And I understand the value of that for sure. That doesn't really line up with the values of a strategy game, though, because in a strategy game, you generally want people to understand all of the rules so that they can, you know, make a decision within the rules. It shouldn't be about even knowing what the rules are, and having that much content necessarily means that it's going to be about knowing what those rules even are. As I've been talking about, rules content are rules. So, like, all of those, you know, different items and monsters and potions and et cetera, those are all extra rules that the player needs to know if they're going to formulate strategy. So, you know, that's the first sort of level, is thinking, oh, wow, I can just make these massive, huge things with no limits. And that's kind of exciting, but it's actually also really problematic for strategy game design. Like, you need to be able to factor in stuff to your strategy. So you need to be able to know what everything is. And that does put like a limit on how inherently complex your game can be. And I'm going to get more into that as we go into this episode. So, you know, if that's not perfectly clear, hopefully that concept will become more realized throughout the episode. So that's the first level, this video game excitement and excitement of what computers can do, which is, you know, really anything. The second level that I experienced was discovering designer board games and figuring out, you know, I mean, we've all grown up with like board games like Risk and Monopoly and games along those lines. Asari and The Game of Life and all those. And those are not very good by almost any metric. I mean, they're all extremely luck-based, very little strategy. They're all right for kids because kids don't understand that they don't have agency when there's like a die roll. They kind of imagine that them rolling a six was them doing something. And they feel they're much more comfortable feeling agency than most adults are with that kind of stuff. So they feel like there's something going on a lot more. But for adults, you know, those games are just really not interesting. They're just not interesting because there aren't interesting decisions to make. They're very highly solvable, very, simple, and, really just boring. So, but once I discovered the world of designer board games, these European, mostly German board games, stuff like games I've brought up in the past, things like Puerto Rico and Rainer Knizia's games. One of my favorites of his is Through the Desert, or just anything in the top 100 of BoardGameGeek.com. There's a ton of stuff on there. I'll link to the Board Game Geek because I think that some listeners, I think in general, most people have kind of wised up to the board game world, but I do think that there's probably going to be some listeners who are really just video game designers and they just play video games and they aren't really aware of designer board games. Or if they have played designer board games, maybe they've only played Settlers of Catan and like one other game, and they don't necessarily have a nice clear picture of like what really is going on in that world, which is very impressive and very interesting. And, you know, a lot of that stuff really was formative for me in terms of formalizing a lot of my theory, game design theory stuff. I discovered that stuff between, I'd say, like 2012. I was really when I discovered that stuff, and it just revolutionized my thinking. I was already really kind of, I knew there was something really wrong with video games as they were. But once I started playing those designer board games, it really just opened my eyes to the problem, which is that these designer board games are like these systems. They actually are difficult to solve. They're not just relying on randomness. They're not just relying on tons and tons of content. They're not relying on all these like sauces. They're actually difficult to solve. They're actually a system. That realization really opened my eyes to the possibilities. And for a while, I was kind of feeling like, and this is what I would kind of consider like the second level of thinking on game design in one way, which is this idea that, you know, board games, the limitations of board games are actually really, really good for a game designer because they stop you from doing like net hack type stuff. It's a lot easier to work with a board game if you can actually make a system. They kind of lead you towards, because of their physical limitations, they kind of like steer you towards the direction of creating systems rather than big boxes of toys, you know, rather than what a lot of video games are, which is highly solvable, highly random things that just really aren't very deep. Of course, there are exceptions, I should mention. I mean, there, you know, Magic the Gathering is probably the worst example of the thing I'm talking about right now. It's not at all an example. It's much more, Magic the Gathering is like the NetHack equivalent for board games. So I'm specifically talking about like these European designer board games. They did a few things. There's a lot behind them, like why they sort of had this weird renaissance in the last 15 years or so. A lot of people have attributed it to their desire to not be violent theme. A lot of people attribute it to their desire to not have a violent theme, actually, which goes back to a previous episode where I talked a lot about violence in games. And I do think that probably, especially German board games, their propensity for avoiding violence meant avoiding direct conflict. And that's something that a lot of board game German designers will actually talk about, that they try to avoid direct conflict. And the reason they're doing this is to do something which I talked about in the last episode, which was, make the game feel more approachable, make it feel less, I'm like stuffing your face in the toilet, make it more family friendly, get rid of stuff like player elimination and a lot of these direct interactions that kind of just don't feel good. And that's the reason that that's mostly the reasons that they did that. But the thing was that that actually was kind of good for game design in the first place, because it turns inputs into the game into input randomness rather than output randomness. And so that was a really good thing, actually. And that, in combination with the limitations of physical components, made them really have to actually think about design, really kind of think about like, okay, we can only have, you know, whatever, 20, 30, 40 rules in this game. So how are we going to pick 20, 30, 40 rules that make this thing come alive and make it actually playable and deep, and not just playable and deep, but like playable for hundreds or thousands of matches? And I you know, I think that they really achieved something awesome with that. And I think that right now, most of the best, if I were to rank my top 100 strategy games ever, you know, probably 90 of them, or like 80 to 90 of them, would probably be board games. Because, not because of anything having to do with just, you know, paper is better than computers, but because there just happened to be this, there was this cultural movement, but also coupled with the sort of disabling people from doing the NetHack thing. And again, I know Magic the Gathering is kind of counter example to that, but most board game designers didn't find it like a reasonable thing to do. Like, it's hard to make all those cards just on like a technical level. Most people who are designing board games really do just want to make something you can put in one box, sell it to someone, and then they can just play it forever. You know, like traditional board games, so like chess and Go. Like, a lot of board game designers want to make something like that, something that's an evergreen system that isn't reliant on a constant feed of new content to function. I guess that in and of itself is another factor. The fact that there's this cultural expectation that a board game is like chess. You know, a board game is a thing that you get it, and then you can play it as much as you want, and it's always going to be there and fun, and it doesn't need constant, you know, balance patches, and it doesn't need constant flowing of new content to be interesting. It's just interesting based on the system itself. So anyway, my point is there's all these reasons for why board games really kind of just took off in terms of becoming interesting systems. And I think they're at the forefront of that, really. And so it's easy to think that, you know, board games are just better than video games, or that cards and paper and the components that we use to make board games are a better medium for making strategy games than the computer. It's easy to think that because, you know, most of the best games are board games. There's these limitations that stop you from going off the rails, or at least curb your desires to do that. And so I think, you know, for a while I was kind of thinking, you know, board game design is where it's at. And, you know, I teach classes on game design sometimes, usually to kids. And, you know, most of the time I do start people off with board games, largely because, okay, you just have paper and a few very simple elements. How can you use design to make something interesting out of this? You know, and I think that's a great challenge and a great starting point. It gets people thinking along the right lines. Whereas, you know, video games, while it's interesting, while video games, like computers, have all this potential, this like massive, huge potential to do anything, I think that maybe partially because of that huge, massive potential, that kind of scares us a little bit. And so maybe that's why, one reason why we have these like really narrow established genres in video games. Like, if someone, 99% of the time, someone goes to design a video game, they're going to be starting with one of these like six or seven genres and just working off of that, like platformer or FPS or RTS, or, you know, there's like three or four others, RPG. And they're going to be starting with this model that's really kind of like a full system, just about ready to go. And, you know, I've talked before about genres and how in video games, genres aren't really genres. They're actually just games. They're like concepts for a game. And so we have these, we have in video games, we have like 10 to 12 games and like 1,000 variations of each. So yeah, I think that the possibility space on computers is kind of intimidating for people, and these genres sort of help people to feel more comfortable, like knowing what to even begin to do. And that's one thing that I think video game developers have to worry about. So like I said, just to review, the first level is being all excited about what computers can do. And then the second level is getting really excited about the restrictions of board games, of physical games, and thinking that that's where the great designs are going to happen. That's the way to design strategy games, is with board game materials. And I was there for a few years, I would say, and I've struggled with many, many board game design attempts since, coming from video games. You know, I mostly work in the world of video games and the world of computers. I must have made, 100 to 200, somewhere in that ballpark, like playable board game prototypes in the last few years. And I've just kind of been hitting some snags keep coming up over and over and over again. And as I learn more about strategy game design, I realize that actually the third level of like understanding this game design on this axis is realizing that you can embrace the elegance of board games, and you can embrace that sort of abstractness and that systemness and that restraint of board games, but use computers. Because here's the thing, board games are great, but the physical components have some restrictions that aren't necessarily ideal for strategy game design. And before I get into that, I should just talk a little bit about just how unlikely the great strategy game design is. Like, I think people think like, well, what's the big deal? You just make a great game, you know? I think that the idea of making a great strategy game means you are inventing, and I think that's the right word, a system that human beings, these like super, super smart animals, can... they can't solve it, but they can piece it together. So they're kind of like, they're using decision making, and they're kind of operating on this like razor thin line between I understand and I don't understand. And so it's one thing to create a system that does that at all. It's another thing to create a system that does that for years and that stays like that. I mean, I think it's an incredible feat to be able to do that at all. I feel like if we've done that, it's been in human history, it's been like less than 100 times or something. It's very rare. And I also think that the games that we'll be making 10 to 20 years from now will just massively blow anything that we have now out of the water on this regard. But my point is that it's really, really, really hard to do this. And it's like not guaranteed that we even kind of can do it. I think most of our approaches and most of our attempts will fail. I think any serious game designer who actually cares about whether their stuff is good will tell you that most stuff that they do, and this goes for any art really, you write like 30 songs for like a 10 song album or something, or you come up with all kinds of like, you write a ton of drafts before you write one article. This is just sort of how creativity works. Like, so many of these little tendrils that go off into one direction just end up going nowhere. And so, yeah, my point is just that strategy games are not a guaranteed thing. Like, they're very, very, very hard to make. And so it's kind of weird to expect that physical components are going to just work for making that kind of a machine. I mean, even with computers, the idea of making this kind of a machine is extremely difficult. And computers are way more flexible than paper and cards and such. Just way, way, way more flexible. Now, one thing that that I've brought up before, if you watched I did a talk at Practice 2013, and I talked a little bit. Soren Johnson did a talk, and we were on a panel together. He's the designer of Civ 4. And he was talking a little bit about board games and kind of this topic, actually, about the design merits of board games, really. And I followed up with him we had like sort of a discussion panel section, and I was saying how, you know, the reason that board games are good is because in order to create a strategy, like to actually operate on a strategic level in a game, you need to be able to fit all of the rules that are active that will actually affect your strategy into your brain. And so, like, you know, a board game kind of forces you to do that anyway, because you actually have to be doing the upkeep of making the game work. You know, you have to like keep moving everything around. There's no like computer in the background that's like making everything keep working the way that there is in video games. And that's one of the really big compelling things about board games, I think, for designers, is this idea that, you know, the rules have to just fit into players' heads so that they can even play the game at all. And that's also a good thing for strategy games, because in order to form strategy, you need to fit the rules into your brain. So if the rules are like this crazy huge thing with all these algorithms hidden everywhere and this giant black box, then all that stuff is just noise. It can't fit into your brain. It can't fit into strategy. It's just noise. So that was my point, and that's how I sort of operated for a very long time. But I have run into some of the problems with board games, with the physical components. And I think it's weird to expect that, you know, just cards and the kinds of things that we deal with in the physical realm would necessarily be good enough to do what we're asking them to do, which is create this crazy system that humans can just barely start to solve. This very, very, like, we're expecting to be able to do brain surgery with, like, you know, a hatchet. It's like that kind of a thing, or like some, even worse than a hatchet. Whereas we have like lasers now, and it's like, well, yeah, let's definitely use lasers. Those are a billion times more precise. And that's kind of the root of my argument, but I will get into some specifics. So yeah, board games have a few restrictions that I've been running into over and over again. And the biggest thing that you got to start with board games is assuming you are making something that you want people to actually play and maybe even like purchase, which I think most game designers do. Most game designers want to make things that other people will play, not that just could theoretically exist. So because, you know, with physical components, technically you could just make a huge computer out of like twigs and stuff. You know, people have done that kind of stuff with like Minecraft. You know, so you can do anything with physical components, but I think it's reasonable to limit board games to the world of stuff that players would reasonably do in a let's play some board games setting scenario. So, you know, things like shuffling cards, dealing out cards, rolling dice, moving pieces together, maybe laying down a bunch of tokens. You know, those are the kinds of things that people will do. Whereas maybe if there's a thing where every turn you have to like upkeep a complicated fog of war system and like keep move around all these tiles and do all this stuff every single turn, you know, that's something a computer would happily do, but a human being would find very irritating and probably would be like too, you know, asking too much of them. So we have these like practical, they're not literal restrictions on the physical board games and stuff, but they are practical limitations that I think we should just assume are, you know, real hard limitations, because most designers who actually care about their craft, and, you know, they care if people will be able to play it. And so let's just say that the practical limitations are the actual limitations. So what are the limitations? Because I think a lot of people don't think that there really are any. There's two things that are the biggest problems with physical board games. One of them is the ability to control the information horizon. And I wrote an article about the information horizon a little while ago, and I talked about chess and how chess is, because you can look ahead as far as you want or as far as you can, it kind of becomes a little bit of a look ahead contest. And even if you set a timer or something, you know, you basically you're just cutting off the contest at that. Like, how many look aheads can you do in 30 seconds? So it still has that kind of quality to it. And, you know, I have talked to a lot of people who play chess and, you know, even serious chess players. And yeah, it kind of, especially around the middle, like intermediate, it seems like it becomes a little bit more gamey. But I can tell you that at the lowest levels, and it seems kind of at the highest levels of play, chess is kind of a look ahead contest. And I would suspect that it's like that at all levels, because the problem is there's no hidden information. So any game that has no hidden information is necessarily has this problem of being kind of a look ahead contest. Assuming there's no, you know, output randomness, it's just a deterministic thing with no hidden information. You should just look at all the options that you can, as many as you can in the time that you have. And hopefully, you know, that and that's, hopefully other people agree that that's the experience of playing these abstract games. And so then on the other hand, of course, it's not as though board games can't do hidden information. They can do hidden information, but they're very limited at where they can set the line, if you will, the horizon of where information comes into the game. So it's very easy to do, you know, something like, every turn you draw a new card. You know, the game Pandemic has that. You draw a new card, and if it's a epidemic, all this terrible stuff happens. But the problem with that kind of thing is then it becomes actually output randomness, because you have no time to respond to that epidemic. It just happens, and it's not like you could see it coming. And that's really the big thing that I talk about, is that, you know, you should be able to see information coming, kind of. You should be able to have some time to respond to information that's about to enter into the game. Whether it's coming from other players or whether it's coming from random sources, you need a little bit of time so that the final outcome of the game is tied to your decision making, and not like just tied to this noise that's just disrupted the whole game. So yeah, of course, now what you could do is you could, in Pandemic, for example, you could have it be that, you know, cards draw out like three at a time or something. And like there's always three cards drawn out. And so you can see cards like three in advance, how they're coming. So you do kind of get that. And there's a few things that you can do like that. But there's a lot you can't do. There's very few ways to really like fine tune control hidden information. You can't really have things like, for example, Fog of War is something you kind of can't really practically do in board games, especially if you want things to be happening in those areas. A sort of complex map generation or tile placement system that is supposed to be random, but is supposed to be kind of controlled and balanced, is also something you kind of can't do. When there's stuff happening in the hidden information area, that's something that board games have a real difficult time with, because the player would have to be managing that stuff and yet not knowing what it is. So I do think that board games have a real problem with hidden information. And specifically setting the perfect horizon for when information comes into the game. I think that it's very cumbersome. It's very coarse, when what we need for that kind of a thing is fine tuning. And it's very difficult. Like, even in that card situation, you know, every turn you draw out, or you draw out three cards, there's always three cards out. And so on my turn, I'll draw one, the front one, the closest one, and then draw another one from the deck to the back of that line, so that you get this slow feeding thing and you can see every card for two turns before it actually activates. Even in that kit situation, like, this is a good example. What if three cards is too much, but two cards is too little? You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of thing that computers can kind of do. They can scale things up flexibly and change everything around in terms of the values. And not to mention doing all this behind the scenes in the fog work that, you know, you don't need to know all the rules for, but to factor into your strategy, because it's ultimately going to be like just random, but maybe there do need to be some rules that are there so that it works better. You know, random map generation, like you don't need to know what all the rules are from random map generation, but there probably do need to be some rules. It can't just be purely random. That's another thing board games have a hard time with, is any kind of decently complex map generation. So there's a bunch of stuff like that, having to do with hidden information that board games just really have difficulty, doing. And I do think that's a problematic restriction. And the other thing is, the idea of information density. So the problem of information density in board games is it's hard to, have each bit of information, each space or each whatever, each part of the game have enough to it so that it's complex enough. And this is why we have games like chess and even Through the Desert, which really are end up being these long look ahead contests, is because each individual interaction is not that deep and not that interesting, and there's not a lot going on. And so we just take this like very, very simple, too simple interaction, and we just multiply it by like 1,000. So now you have to do this simple thing 1,000 times, and then it kind of feels like it's complicated, even though it's not. What we want, now if, here's the thing, if we're starting off with, okay, we want a healthy information horizon, so you can see a decent amount of what's coming into the game space. But not too much and not too little. It's like this perfect little Goldilocks amount of information that you have direct access to. So within that, though, it's still that area has to be unsolvable. And in order to achieve that, that means that each element needs to be pretty complex. So to use an example that I use sometimes, which is my own game, Oro. And that game has, so you have this big map of tiles. They're hexagonal tiles, and you're moving around on this map and you're bumping monsters. And the thing is, it restricts your view to a 7x7 tile radius around your player. And it's always there. You can't move it. You can't expand it. You can't do anything to it. And that's a very functional thing. So it's like, as you move down the level, you're revealing new monsters and they're coming into play, and you have a couple of turns to deal with them before they can really activate on you. They even start asleep, actually. So the first turn you move, they're not going to do anything. And that's one little thing that's just like, you know, an asleep buff like that already. That's pretty simple. But doing something like that in a board game is like, okay, I got to get some kind of like token or something, or maybe I could flip the thing upside down, or, you know, but there's something that you got to do. And then if you need one other thing, forget it. It's like way too much stuff already. And I think that some people might be saying, yeah, well, that's good. That shows how board games are good. And yeah, maybe that's true in that case. But the point is there's an inflexibility there that is problematic sometimes. For example, in Oro, back to this Oro example, you know, you have these abilities that, like, for example, one lets you jump, one lets you create a icy space, etc. So all these abilities, not only do they have like a basic effect and they do these things, but they also have like edge case and corner case behaviors, things like little details about how they work, which, you know, often aren't super useful, but like in these little, sometimes they are, and you can factor them into your strategy. For example, most of the abilities in the game leave some terrain effects. So, you know, for example, when you jump or when you dash, it leaves these little vortexes on the map where you jumped or where you dashed. And those vortexes can be used to launch monsters a lot farther and, you know, help you get kills. That's the kind of thing. It's like in a board game. So in a board game version of Oro, for example, I mean, we have a character who has health, and we have all these monsters that are on the the field, and each of them has some pieces of information, like their heavies or their, you know, they have this ability, that ability. I mean, I've tried to make a board gamey version of Oro, like something that's like an approximation. And the table just gets covered very quickly with like all these little sheets. Like you need a piece of paper that says the information about brutes, which is one of our types of monsters. And like how they interact with currents and all this stuff. Like there's a lot of rules. And I suppose one way to put my point is just that board games push you to have too few rules, and video games kind of allow you to have too many rules. And what we really need is something kind of in between. And I actually think that Oro, a lot of people, it strikes them as weird, because I do think it is already kind of in between. It sort of feels like a board game and it sort of feels like a video game. It doesn't really feel like either one. And I think that's because it's in this middle area where it has enough complexity. It has too much complexity to be a board game, but it's too simple to be a video game. And I think that leads into this point, this larger point that I wanted to make. I wanted to read this one comment from a user named Livrem, Livrem, Livrem. They wrote a TLDR, so I'll read that part. It says, "Clockwork game design is great, but it should be clarified that it applies to abstract strategy games only, and parts of it is irrelevant when you want to make or play themed games or non-strategy games, and that should be made much cleared by the author." I think he means clearer. So I think I do make it reasonably clear that this is a podcast about strategy game design. As to the abstract claim, that's a totally different thing. A big thing is like, how do we define abstract game? Because to me, an abstract game are things like chess and go, and also things like Tetris, things where there is literally no theme or no setting, no discernible setting, and the interactions are very, very simple. And one of the big points that I want to make in this podcast episode are that abstract games are inherently flawed because they are too simple. The interactions are too simple. They're like necessarily too simple. Theme is actually really important for strategy games because it allows us to have a level of complexity that we wouldn't otherwise really be able to communicate. If Oro was abstract, or some other games were purely abstract, some other strategy games were purely abstract, they'd just be harder to understand. It would be harder to understand what's going on. Theme is a kit of metaphors that helps us digest and like quickly understand certain interactions, even complicated interactions. And so I think that I actually am against abstract games. So like, not only is this podcast not only for abstract games, but I actually think abstract games are inherently flawed and people shouldn't be making abstract games. Now, maybe someone would say Oro is an abstract game. I wouldn't say that. I think that it has enough thematic complexity and stuff going on that it's not abstract. I mean, first of all, it has art and it has a setting and it has characters and it technically even has like a story and stuff. So calling it abstract to me sounds like a stretch. But I also think that the games, there is a sort of middle ground between like video gamey and abstract, or even like board game. So at the lowest level, where you have like the least information per piece, if you will, that would be abstract games like Go and chess. Go has got to be at the very bottom in terms of like you can't get any more simple in terms of, you know, abstractness. It's just a grid with circles. That's all Go is in terms of theme. And then above that, you have like board game level. So you have like games like Puerto Rico, Agricola, Pandemic, Through the Desert, even things like Race for the Galaxy. And then like, I would say way above that, we have video games and also things like Magic the Gathering, but primarily like, you know, video games, StarCraft, Street Fighter, all those ones that I always talk about. League of Legends, certainly. And there's a giant gap in between what we have in the board game world and what we have in the video game world. And I'm saying, let's make games in that gap. There's somewhere in there, that's where we should actually be operating. The computer's world is way too complicated, way too much stuff, way too complex. We have all these, like, every actor has, like, a whole stats sheet of, like, his hit points and his mana and his mana regeneration rate and his, you know, like, cooldown reduction and, like, all this crazy stuff. That's way too much. But on the other hand, the board game stuff where it's, like, all you can do is, like, you know, this one game, Neuroshima Hex, is, like, one of the more complex. It tries to solve this problem, I feel like. But it's, like, really crowded. Like, it has all these, like, little icons and stuff to try to tell you, oh, this has, like, armor against this, and, like, if a unit has health, you have to put these little pips, these little physical, like, tokens on the thing. And it's just, like, it's, like, it's pushing up against the upper limits of board game complexity per piece. And so that's a problem, I think. We should be making games in that middle area, and there is a middle area there. So the idea of this being a podcast about abstract games, I wholly reject that totally. Unless you're considering anything less more abstract than video games, than like League of Legends. If you're saying everything below that is abstract, then okay, I guess technically. But my point is, above, you know, Euro games, which I don't think most people consider abstract. Maybe they consider them a little abstract, but anything above those, but below League of Legends, there's a large area there, and I don't consider that abstract. Before I finish up, I also want to talk about, you know, I think that this, when we do operate in this world, in that little, like, middle area of more abstract than board games, but less than video games, I do think that people are going to find that strange and off-putting. I mean, I think any new system, any new, truly new invention, which is what I think game designs are going to be, you know, it's a little bit of a challenge getting people to, like, understand it and get into it. But I think that the "is this abstract or isn't it" kind of quality is also a little bit weird for people. You know, people are used to, okay, this is a fantasy simulation. Straight up fantasy simulation. You're literally looking at a battlefield, you know, that kind of stuff. They're totally used to that. They're totally used to also this idea of a super abstract thing that's like, looks like Sudoku or a crossword puzzle or something. That's also totally, we're very acquainted with both of those things. We're acquainted with movies, and we're very well acquainted with, you know, writing, text, books. I mean, you know, prose on a page is just literally abstract representations of ideas. We're not that acquainted, really. And maybe people can tell me in the comments some ideas about where we would see something in between. I guess what I would say as a good example might be things like cartoons and comics, which are kind, like, especially like highly stylized cartoons. They're real enough that there's information there, like in terms of like what Charlie Brown looks like, but they're also abstracted enough that they're flexible and that they're, you know, kind of weird. Perry Bible Fellowship is actually a better example of that. You know, his stuff is, this is a comic strip by Nicholas Gurwitch, which I highly recommend if people haven't read it, but it kind of straddles this weird line between, and he actually plays with, sometimes he uses realism to get an effect, but a lot, the basis of his stuff is these like, cartoonified stick figure characters, which, at first glance, they kind of look abstract, but there's actually a lot of information that they contain. They are like very expressive and emotive, and they do these poses that are actually, there's a lot of information there. And you know, his stuff sort of spans that middle area between abstract or like above abstract. He never does just like stick figures, like straight up pretty much. And he never does just like a whole thing that's all photorealistic. Even if it kind of looks photorealistic rendering, he is stylizing, heavily. And, you know, the thing I love about his comics, and I think this is something that we should learn and apply to our game designs, is that his theme and his rendering style and all that kind of stuff is always set up to support the joke. He always starts with a joke and he builds a world like around that joke and not everything, like the, you know, where it takes place, who the characters are, and even the rendering style is all in support of that joke, which is the core of his work. And I don't know that he thinks about it that way, but that's what he ends up doing. And that's why I think they're really successful and great comics. And so I think that, you know, similarly, us as game designers, we need to build games that operate in that same way, that live in that middle area where we're abstract enough that we can be loose, but we are also sort of realistic enough that we can be complex and deep. And so that's my big lesson that I have for this episode. I still do operate with board games, but I mostly use them as like a teaching tool and for making like party games and social games. For serious strategy game design, I've mostly abandoned that medium, and I would encourage other experienced designers to probably do the same and just operate in using computers for their serious strategy games. And so that's my big lesson, and hopefully I've made a good case for that. If not, of course, please let me know in the comments, and you know, we'll talk about it in a future episode again if there's enough of a response. So thank you so much for listening, and I will see you again next time. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a patron by going to www.patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Thanks for listening.